Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, getting a mortgage is pretty simple. If you have a stable job and a good credit score, tons of financial institutions are more than happy to give you credit. But what if your story isn't simple? Maybe you're a new business owner without a track record. You're going through a divorce. Maybe you're new to Canada. Securing a mortgage for those folks isn't so easy. Robert Millister is a mortgage commentator, founder of RateSpy.com, and he's going to join us to talk about securing a mortgage when your situation is a bit out of the ordinary. Then, can money really buy you happiness? We're going to talk to money expert and author Melissa Leong about her book, Happy Go Money. And we'll talk to Bolola Sakubi, founder of Clever Girl Finance, about how she pursued her dream of financial independence. Plus, personal finance tips for entrepreneurs, and the new editor-in-chief of Money Sense, Sandra Martin, is here to talk about what is next for the Personal Finance Magazine. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Securing a mortgage isn't always easy, especially if your situation itself isn't so simple. Maybe you're an entrepreneur without a regular income. Maybe you're a new immigrant with no credit history here in Canada. Or maybe you're going through some big life change like a divorce or something. Whatever the case may be, the process of getting a mortgage can be really daunting. Rob McLister is the founder of mortgage rate comparison website RateSpy.com. He joins us now from Naples, Florida, to tell us about some tough cases he's seen in the past and to talk about some solutions. If those are your circumstances, hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Good chat with you.
You're Canadian, but you were smart enough to get a place in Florida. Nice, because the weather here is still not spring or summer.
Yeah, no, I'm just riding things out. Let me know when it warms up up there, and I'll be right back.
At this rate, it could be another season or two. Who knows? I did reference a couple of examples where getting a mortgage isn't as easy. Give us a flavor for some of the tough cases that you've seen in the past where it has been difficult for someone to secure a mortgage the traditional way.
Yeah, you know, if you're just a regular person, well-qualified, you're buying a house or refinancing, life is usually pretty simple. If you're, you know, encountering some life challenges, maybe you're going through a divorce or, you know, you're a brand new business owner without a heck of a lot of experience, or you're new to the country and you don't have a lot of credit history, those are examples of when you can find challenges in the mortgage process.
What are some solutions that people can pursue if those are their circumstances?
Well, we can start with divorce. That's a good one. A lot of people get divorced in this country. So typically in those situations, you have one spouse that's buying out the other. You got to take the other spouse off title. So, you know, here's a simple example. Pretend you have a husband and wife. They got a $500,000 home, and the wife wants to stay, and the husband's leaving the house, and they got 20% equity. And assuming that they get along and they've agreed to split equity nice and easy, then each of them would get 10% of the home value when all said and done. So essentially in that case, you know, the wife would get a new mortgage, pay out the existing mortgage, and buy out the husband. And then the husband gets his 10%, the wife keeps her 10%, and Bob's your uncle. And that's, you know, it sounds simple, the way I put it, but there are little hitches that come up along the way. For example, we've had clients where they can't agree on the separation agreement. So most lenders require a fully executed separation agreement. And, you know, I've seen cases where, you know, the husband and wife hate each other and they want to part ways, but they can't get the separation agreement banged out. And it takes 6 or 12 months longer to negotiate and close.
Let's go to the entrepreneur example here, because that's a situation a lot of people find themselves in. How do you get financing when you don't have a T4 that illustrates your income for the last X number of years?
Yeah, so most self-employed programs require 2 years of self-employment and at least 2 years of tax returns, CRA notices of assessment, and if you have a corporation, unaudited financials. Now, someone that is newly self-employed, that's where you have more challenges. Fortunately, CMHC came out with a program not too long ago that makes it easier for folks that have been self-employed only recently and or don't have traditional proof of income. So they might be able to use things like signed contracts or, you know, previous proof of income. Mm-hmm. a similar role or have, you know, just a lot of cash reserves, and CMHC will consider that.
What about co-signing? Having someone co-sign on your mortgage?
Well, anytime you don't have enough income to get approved, co-signing is always an option. So, you know, going back to the divorce situation, if you're a wife and you're staying in the home and you can't qualify on your own, you know, maybe you have a new boyfriend or whatnot that wants to go along for the ride in the mortgage, and we can use his income to qualify.
What part of credit history can be ported from one country to another? Is that a way to sort of build up the case that you're good for the cash?
So if you're talking about a new immigrant situation, someone with no credit history in Canada, then, you know, the lender, most lenders will allow a foreign credit report. And if that's too hard to get for some reason, then some lenders will allow alternative proof of credit, like a bank reference letter or proof that you paid your rent on time for a year, that kind of thing.
How do lenders factor in qualitative things? Like back in the day, you'd think, well, I've got a good relationship with the bank manager, or I've got a case that really pulls at the heartstrings. Where's the wiggle room?
Well, those, you know, those face-to-face meetings with your lender don't happen as often as they used to back in the day. You know, most people now, many people don't even meet their mortgage broker, don't even meet their banker. It's all done by phone and internet. So that face-to-face looking in someone's eye and seeing if you have a good feeling about them, that doesn't factor in as much anymore.
Educators Financial Group is a they do mortgages. They also do financial planning now. They were founded, 30 or 40 years ago, because some teachers found it hard to qualify for mortgages back then. How much would you say the industry has evolved over the last couple of decades of thinking more holistically about what makes a good bet?
Well, if you're talking about qualifications, so we had obviously the mother of all recessions, you know, a little over 10 years ago, and things tightened up significantly. Now, they're starting to loosen up more. So you're starting to see, you know, things like, you know, stated income come back, interest-only mortgages, that type of thing. And so there's always an option for you. It really depends on how much equity you have. That's always the main factor. There's a lot of lenders in Canada, specifically private lenders, that will take a chance on you, even if you can't prove your income, so long as you have, you know, a 35% down payment, for example, in a marketable home.
There are a lot of people who work in the gig economy, so they don't have jobs. Maybe they drive for Uber. Maybe they're on short-term contracts. How do lenders look at people without traditional jobs these days?
So that's a little bit of a gap in the mortgage process, and probably one that will get addressed at some point. But certainly if you have, you know, your little side job and you can prove income for 2 years, then it's much easier. If you can't, then your traditional lender options are much fewer.
Where do you go if you don't qualify for a mortgage at a traditional bank or even one of the big secondary lenders? I mean, there's a lot of talk about private lenders and those sorts of things. What's your view on that?
So private lenders and mortgage investment companies are surging, as are non-prime lenders. So the lenders that take a little bit more risk in exchange for a higher rate and fees. That whole segment of the market is growing gangbusters. And, you know, the banks are actually losing some market share, and a lot of it is because of government rule tightening. But like I said before, if you have enough equity and you have a marketable home, there's usually a way to get you financed.
What note of caution would you have for people who are considering going the private lender route?
Well, there's some people that just feel they have to get into the housing market, and you know they're willing to pay a 7 or 8% interest rate in order to buy a house when they've been turned down at banks and alternative lenders. And that's a scary thing. And you know, the stress test in general, I'm in support of it. But when it comes to people who are refinancing, you know, they have been disproportionately negatively affected by the stress test because sometimes life happens, right? You have an illness, you get divorced, you lose your job, whatever, and you have all this debt that you got to get rid of. And the, you know, traditionally back in the day, a lot more people could refinance with a traditional lender at very good rates. Now, after the B20 stress test came in, that's harder to do for some people. So people are racking up debt at very high rates, and eventually you have to pay the piper.
One last question before we go. Looking to the future, what is the role of technology going to be, and will it help or hinder some of those people who have a less traditional, you know, work narrative, like entrepreneurs, like immigrants? Is AI and other fintech entries going to help or hinder them?
You know, I don't look at it as much of a big benefit in terms of qualification, you know, helping you get a mortgage or get approved for a mortgage. But in terms of comparing mortgages and actually finding the best deals, that's where technology is having a major impact. Someday, you're going to be able to go to a website, talk to a bot, and get amazing mortgage advice without ever talking to a human being, without having to listen to someone's sales spiel or whatnot. And that type of technology is coming faster than you think.
You can spend all year in Naples, Florida. Well, I guess in the heat of summer, you don't want to be there, right?
Oh, no, we got to get back to the snow.
Rob McLister, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Rob McLister, founder of RateSpy. We were talking about what to do if your situation is somewhat out of the ordinary when it comes to getting a mortgage to buy a home.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Bola Shakumbi was able to save an impressive $100,000 in 3 years after finishing college. This led her to start her very own web platform, which has become a book. It is called Clever Girl Finance, and its intention is to help guide other women to achieve success through their own financial journeys. She joins us now to talk about her story and what other women might be able to do to achieve financial independence for themselves. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
You saved, as I said, $100,000 3 years after finishing college. You live in New Jersey. Did you work for Tony Soprano? Did you work for any of his other affiliated crime families in order to pay off whatever debt you had and save that amount of money?
No, I did not. I did it through hard work.
Also an option. Less interesting for a TV show, but also interesting. So hard work and what? Tell us a bit about how you did it.
Oh, my God. So it was a crazy, intense experience. You know, I set this goal to save money coming out of college. I was making $54,000 working in New York City. After taxes, it came out to about $40,000, and I thought I was rich. It was the most money I had ever made in my entire life. And so I set this goal to save as much as I could possibly save, and I started by contributing to my retirement account. So in the States, we have something called a 401k, and I started putting some money in there. Next, I focused on keeping my expenses super low. And so outside of my mortgage and a car note I was paying, I got really, really lean on expenses. I was eating breakfast and lunch at work, you know, strolling through the offices, seeing who was having a baby shower or a retirement party and being like, hey, congratulations. I don't know who you are, but I'll take the free lunch.
Nice.
And really, you know, taking advantage of the free perks at work. And then I focused on saving 40 to 50% of every paycheck I got and anything extra. So think about tax refunds, any small bonuses, anything like that. I saved half of it. And so I basically made myself live on that initial salary. And when I got raises, I tried to save as much as possible of my raises, if not all of my raises.
Now, I used to... Hold on here. I used to live in New York City. It is the most extraordinary city on the planet. There are people trying to get you to part with every single penny you have every hour of every day. How on earth did you withstand the urge to, I don't know, just go to Birdland or take in a Broadway show just once?
Fortunately for me, I worked in consulting, technology consulting, and I was traveling all over the whole place, all over the country. And so I didn't really have that much time to loiter around New York and find ways to spend my money because I was always in some different city on a plane somewhere doing work.
Wow. Have you lightened up since then?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, doing that savings journey, like getting really aggressive with saving, I even made myself busier by starting a side hustle to increase my income, which was part of what allowed me to save that $100K. But once I got over that $100K hump, I kind of took a deep breath. I was like, wait a minute, I actually did this. I can calm down a little bit and, you know, just take it all in. So I did slow down.
Now, of course, everyone is an individual, but what would you say are some characteristics or experiences that women share that might be different from men when it comes to their financial journey?
Oh, so that's a great question. And specifically for women, you know, there's a number of things about us that make us, you know, different. So for one thing, we live longer than men on average, which means we need more money across our lifetimes. A lot of us take time off of work, either temporarily or permanently, to have children, to raise children. This also impacts, you know, our finances and our lifetime earnings. As women, we are also very generous and giving. We give to everybody, our children, our spouses, our family, and we typically tend to think of ourselves last. And so these factors, and when you add on the, you know, gender wage gap, which if you break it down by demographic is just really depressing, these factors impact the way we deal with money and basically should be, they're the motivation as to which we should want to do better with our finances. Mm.
You have made money mistakes in the past. I was very gratified to hear that you were enticed by the credit card companies and their free T-shirts. How did you redeem yourself? How did you unwind that credit card addiction that is ever present for so many people?
Oh my God, the credit card story. So, you know the story from the book is I got this credit card that they sold to me as free money at a 24.99% interest rate. And basically when I got to that point where I had maxed out the credit card, I got like the first bill in the mail. I was just so terrified because I didn't know what I had done with the money and I didn't even really have the income to pay it back at the time. And so I called my mom and I was crying. I was like, oh my God, mom, I'm in trouble. And she's like, really? You better get your life together, get a job, start making money and pay off that debt. And so I basically got really lean and mean with my tiny paycheck. I was on a ramen noodles and Coke diet, and it took me several months to pay off the credit card. It was $2,000. It might as well have been $2 million with what I was earning, but it really taught me lessons about, you know, budgeting and being intentional about how I was spending my money and understanding how credit cards work, especially with interest rates and what it can cost you in the long run.
Your story is really compelling. Going back to your upbringing in Nigeria, the trade-offs that your parents had to make to send you and your brother to college, all that kind of stuff. What do you think was most formative about their imprinting on you and how you behave as an adult based on how you grew up?
For me, it was watching my mom and watching her interactions with her friends. So my mom got married really young. She got married at 19, had four kids, was a stay-at-home mom. And as she started getting older in her marriage, she started to see things around her that she didn't like. She started to see her friends getting divorced or unfortunately a spouse would pass away. And the woman, her friend, would just be stuck with no idea of the family finances or where things were. And I remember growing up, my mom would have friends over in our house and she would be trying to console them. You know, I'm so sorry. Or her friends would stay with us for a few days or a couple of weeks while they tried to figure out what to do next. And so that really left an impression on me because it made me realize that if you didn't have money, you didn't have options. And for my mom in particular, it really left an impression on her because after she saw her friends going through that, you know, getting married at 19 with just a high school diploma, she decided that she never wanted to be in that position. And so I remember going with her to her college classes. My mom was about 33 or 34 at the time, sitting down in the corner. She got her undergrad, her master's, and she aggressively started to save money through her full-time job and through businesses that she was running to the point where she was able to pay for my college education in cash, which was an incredible opportunity because she did this at a great expense to herself and her retirement plan.
Wow. You've got a lot of resources both in the book and on Clever Girl Finance. One of them is talking about something you call the Clever Girl Fund. What is that?
Your Clever Girl Fund is basically your bail yourself out of any kind of situation fund. You know, you lose your job, your car breaks down, you need to get a new water heater, you need to buy an emergency plane ticket. This is basically the fund that gives you the option to deal with that situation without derailing your financial plans, without having to go liquefy your investments. And so I'm a huge advocate of having a Clever Girl Fund. You want to have this money as your backup in the event of an unplanned life circumstance.
Mm. What's in the 26-week savings challenge?
It's all about saving your first $1,500. So this challenge is a lot of fun. And we do this on Clever Girl Finance as a way to build the habit of saving money, especially for people who kind of struggle with putting money aside. So we start with a dollar and it builds up to you being able to save over $1,500 in in about 26 weeks. And every week there's a challenge to help you save. So this week it could be meal planning. Next week it could be cutting back on subscriptions. The following week it could be returning things or selling things in your closet. So we make it fun and engaging and basically keep you motivated as you work on saving that first amount of money.
Thank you so much for telling us all about Clever Girl Finance, and your story, your personal story, is a real inspiration, Bola. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Bola Shakumbi joined us from New Jersey. She is the author of Clever Girl Finance, which is both a online platform and also a book. Stay with us. Coming up next, we'll talk to the editor-in-chief of Money Sense magazine. Sandra Martin will be here talking about what's next for personal finance in Canada. And later, how to make your dream of turning your side hustle into a full-time business. Michael Contento, CEO of My Blue Umbrella, will be here. If you want some more Moolala, you can go to our website, moolala.ca, or go to any of the podcasting platforms. You can download the full podcast. You can write a review. You can even subscribe to the podcast so the next episode will magically arrive right on your device. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Money Sense is a storied Canadian personal finance brand. It was launched 20 years ago and has covered every money angle imaginable with an objective, no-nonsense approach. Rogers Media recently sold the brand to rate comparison website RateHub, and now the site is getting set for hopefully another 20 years or so. Sandra Martin is the new editor-in-chief of MoneySense.ca. She joins us now. Hello, Sandra.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
Well, I have full skin in this game, given that I have been a columnist for MoneySense for 7 years. Even as long as I've been around, though, you preceded me first working on the brand. What? Like right around the time that it launched, right?
Yeah, so MoneySense was launched in 1999, and after the founding editor-in-chief, Ian McGugan, I believe I was the fourth employee to be hired.
Wow. So tell me how it feels to be back.
Well, you know, I've been in the magazine biz for quite a while, even longer than MoneySense has been alive, so you can do the math and figure out how old I am, approximately. Yep. But it feels great to be back at a brand that is so beloved, that's so trusted, and to know that with a technology company now really, you know, providing support for it, that there's a plan to take it into a digital future. You know, as I think we've seen, people's reading and content consumption habits have changed over the years. MoneySense launched as a print magazine. We also had a website, but really the website at that time was a place where if you missed the magazine on newsstand, you could see the articles after the fact. And what we didn't know at that time is what we were basically preparing our readers to get used to not paying for content. Mm. So, I mean, you know, anyone can access any of the information on MoneySense for free, and that will never change. The problem is creating great content costs money. Yeah. We have to pay people like yourself who are experts, whether they're journalists or content experts in their field, so that they can do the research and take the time to do really well-founded, credible journalism. That takes money. And unfortunately, there are no more print magazines that used to have these huge advertising revenues from full-page, full-color ads. That doesn't exist anymore. Well, I mean, it exists in a much, much smaller way. So the way forward with content is to really figure out how to make it work in digital. And I, one of the things that convinced me to come back that I'm really excited about is that RateHub is the owner of MoneySense, and they have such great history. They've got a fantastic track record, huge growth, and really understanding the digital space.
You spent a lot of time after you left MoneySense back in the day. You did a lot of work in the world of lifestyle, parenting, you know, food, entertaining, Canadian living, all that stuff. How do you apply that? Are there going to be more photo shoots of delicious food on MoneySense.ca? How are you going to bring that to bear?
I mean, I don't think we're ever going to start running recipes like we did at Canadian Living or even at Today's Parent. But it's not that different in that money is part of your life. You know, we don't view it as being a hobby that you have. It's not like, yeah, I don't really play golf, so I don't ever need to read this golf magazine. We all need to be better about our money. And that includes those of us who've been writing about money for a long time, those of us who are in the industry, as well as people who are just starting out, or maybe they're on their third mortgage or their fifth mortgage, but they feel like they want to be better at negotiating. There's always a way for each one of us to get better and smarter and make more informed decisions about our money choices.
My dad has been a loyal MoneySense reader since the very, very beginning. He's 83 years old right now and still to this day misses the print publication. But he is not the future of personal finance or of the publication. How do you attract a younger audience?
It really, it's by being where younger readers are. So reaching out, you know, social media helps with that, but also providing the information that younger audiences need. So rather than focusing on, you know, RRSPs, which, I mean, I've had an RRSP since I started working in the summers at 16, because my dad was a big money guy. Mm-hmm. And like your dad, he's been reading MoneySense since 1999. You know, really focusing on for that age group and that life stage, money advice and information that will help make them better at their decisions where they are now. So that's the key. I mean, I think there have been different views of what MoneySense should be over the years, and none of it was bad. I think all of it was great. We may have not been paying enough attention to people who are starting out in recent years, and that's going to change. It already is starting to change.
We talk a lot about the generations and how they are similar, how they are different. One of the themes for millennials is the sense that they value experiences over material things or even over retirement savings. Like they're okay to car share and they're happy to rent their house instead of buying some of them. What would you say are the real differences in terms of the generations? And what are just the easy headlines, the listicles, the stereotypes?
That's a great question. I mean, I think some of the divide in outlook comes from what the opportunities are, which is not to say, you know, that our parents didn't have a difficult time saving up for their first down payment, covering the repayment costs on a car. But life is a little bit simpler then. There was less competition in the workplace for many, many people. And I think because millennials are coming into this world, which is so technologically driven, the competition is stronger than ever. I mean, something that we can say for certain is the education level that you're competing with when you go for a job is generally much higher than, you know, when your dad and my dad were going out for a job in their 20s. You know, lots of people went straight to work out of high school and worked their way up the ladder. That doesn't happen quite as much. So I think the outlook is, you know, for millennials, and I have many friends who are in that group, is, you know, we don't really know what the future is going to bring. We don't feel that sense of certainty that maybe previous generations did about the Canada Pension Plan taking care of us in retirement. And we actually want different things. You know, sometimes millennials get criticized for wanting too much. I think it's really different things and maybe daring to live a little larger than our earlier generations did. Even I'm a Gen Xer. I think we were told, don't expect too much and work your butt off and you'll end up somewhere in the middle and you'll be good. I think millennials dare to dream a bit bigger.
Yeah.
And their financial expectations, not necessarily of their income, but what they want out of life is maybe a bit bigger. So that's why they're saying, you know what, I don't really need to be tied to a mortgage.
Yeah.
I'd rather save up for that life-changing trip or whatever that is.
I want to come back to the model. So there's a UK site called Money Saving Expert, right? It's also owned by a rate comparison site. And their model is lead generation, basically. It sounds like MoneySense.ca is moving in that direction. How is that different from ads or subscriptions? How does it work?
Okay, so let's start with ads, which I think most people are more familiar with. So what we call in the business display ads. In digital, that might be a banner that's at the top of your screen or a narrow, tall ad at the side. Advertisers pay money to put a pre-created piece of artwork or messaging in that space in the hope that eyeballs will see it. And then in the print magazine, as I mentioned, there would be largely full page, but sometimes fractional ads that were in the print magazine and advertisers would pay to be in there, really paying to be in front of the eyeballs of the subscribers and newsstand readers. Because readership has changed and because the format of content has changed and is largely digital, advertisers are doing more and more to get the attention of people who've become accustomed to seeing those ad units and really gloss over them, or they may even just not like them so much that they pay for ad blockers. So display ads are less effective than they were even a few years ago, because people have gotten accustomed to seeing them and they don't really pay attention to them. So, you know, it's not different from other so-called consumer magazine media brands that are employing affiliate links. So that's in the case. I'll explain how it works. It's a bit of a complicated process. So
I've only got about 30 seconds, I'm afraid.
So a writer, an editor, journalist creates an article completely unbiased. If there happens to be a mention of an affiliate partner, that partner gets linked to and very transparently labeled as, hey, if you click on this, you're going to go to our partner site. But the number one thing to remember is that an editor or a journalist, somebody unbiasedly created that content. So the content is great. It would be the same content with or without the affiliate link. The affiliate link just helps us pay for new content in the future.
We've just got to figure out a way to make journalism work. So maybe this is the answer. Who knows? Sandra, thank you very much for joining us. Congrats on your new gig. And fingers, toes, and eyes crossed that Money Sense will continue to tell these great stories for decades to come.
Well, really hope people check out moneysense.ca. And thanks for having me on, Bruce.
You're welcome. Sandra Martin, the new editor-in-chief of moneysense.ca. Coming up later, we're going to bring Sandra back to talk about how she manages her own money. No secrets. It's all on the table. But next, we're going to talk to personal finance columnist about her book, Happy Go Money. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, it's very easy to get caught up. You can go to our website, moolala.ca. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms and search there. But I will say, on that website, you can search by subject line. You can listen to just segments. It's super easy to find the content that you're looking for. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
They say money can't buy you happiness, perhaps, but it's also fair to say that money and happiness are pretty closely linked, in our minds at least. Personal finance columnist Melissa Leong has written a book that looks at many of those connections and how to make them work for you. She is the author of Happy Go Money. Hello there, Melissa.
Hi, Bruce.
Now,
very
disclaimer, I'm so happy to be talking about it. The disclaimer here is I have known about this book for a long time, and I have been rooting for you, and I'm so, so glad to see that it is in print.
And I am so happy to be talking to you about it. And disclaimer of my own, I did come to you when it was in infancy, trying to brainstorm a title. And the title, I want everybody to know, it's actually your idea.
Well, I love the title, and I came up with the title. I spent a lot of time, you know, I do these books all the time. I can't read cover to cover every single one, but I really loved your book. It is honest, it is practical, it is well-researched, and most importantly, it is very, very funny. I actually did a spit take when I read the sentence, insurance is a borgasm. Like, I actually spat out the water that was in my mouth. What compelled you to write this book?
What compelled me to write this book was, originally, I wanted to consolidate all of my knowledge about personal finance into some sort of fun, great guy. But there are a lot of those out there, including yours. And so it sort of hung around with my literary agent and in my head for a few years. And then I had a personal, it's not a tragedy. I had a
crisis.
An unfortunate crisis in my life that inspired most of the story and most of the book. And the reason why I went on the happiness journey.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about that. We've been on the show before. We've talked about it. Your husband had a mental health crisis.
He did. We had just gotten married. And I mean, I permandated him for 10 years. So it's not like I was expecting anything out of the ordinary. But he had a bad reaction to sleeping pills and fell into a deep depression. He had anxiety and suicidal ideation and was eventually hospitalized. And during that time, you know, Sean is the happy one out of the two of us. He is.
That's saying something.
He makes me laugh every single day. And in that time, the only thing I could think of to do was to try to be happy. And so I went on this quest to learn everything that I could, because I'm a journalist. I download information into my brain to try to help other people and to help myself. And so I learned everything I could about positive psychology. And this book is a culmination of that and money.
Now, the other through line in the book, you've suffered a series of miscarriages. So it's not that you have had some easy hooray for everything privileged life. You really have been in the trenches for many, many years. When do you first remember that you had a role to play in your own happiness, that it was actually something that you could do something about versus just, you know, wait for all the treats to be delivered by Amazon Prime to your door?
Well, I think I remember having a conversation with my best friend about it was when my husband was extremely sick, and she asked me to rate my happiness on a scale of 1 to 10. And I said, after relaying some horrible story to her, I said a 7. And she thought, oh my God, your life is a 7, then mine's a 12.
Right.
And I realized in that moment that all of the tools that I had used to try to bring myself to a happier state were actually working, because, you know, when I wrote the book, some early feedback that I got was that almost a year, you know, it's so nice. You're a 7. Yay, you. But, you know, other people may be a 3. And I thought, I am naturally a 3. You know, I'm a worrier. Mm. I went into journalism so I can professionally complain.
Right. And so, put yourself in environments where all sorts of terrible things are happening.
Yes, doom and gloom every day. It bleeds, it leads, right? And so my own personal journey, yes, I mean, nobody's life is a walk in the park, right? Everybody has to deal with their own struggles. And so for me, it was just a conversation that I wanted to have with others about, okay, well, how are you trying to get happy? I bet you're trying to buy it.
Mm. And that don't work. Now, you said that even in your worst times, that you never worried about money, paying your bills, or losing your home. Why not?
Correct. Because I had set our finances up in a way when my husband and I got married that unknowingly at the time that basically insulated us during that storm. And so we bought the sliver of the townhouse with the triangular shaped rooms you can't fit beds in. Like, I didn't want that house in the boonies. But we bought it because we could afford it on one income, because we thought it would give us opportunities to stay home with a kid. One of us would not work. I had disability insurance. We pulled some emergency funds, which came in handy, because when Sean was looking to go to a treatment center, they start $10,000. They're expensive.
Yeah.
And we wanted to do everything we could to get him back to a stable place. And finally, we skipped our honeymoon because we had paid off our wedding in cash, and we didn't want to go into any kind of debt, because he is very averse to debt, and so am I. And that, all of those things, when the storm came a couple months later, we didn't have debt to worry about. We didn't worry about losing our home. We didn't worry about not being able to pay for the things that really mattered in that moment.
Melissa Leong, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Melissa is the author of Happy Go Money, an extraordinary new book that will have you think very differently about your happiness, about your money, and about your life. Coming up next on Moolala, tips on entrepreneurship from an entrepreneur, Michael Contento, CEO of My Blue Umbrella, with some ideas on personal finances for those heading out on their own. And we take editor-in-chief of Money Sense, Sandra Martin, through how I do it. We'll get a sense of how she manages her money. Hey, I'm a money columnist for Money Sense, close to home. You can look at some of the pieces that we do and I have done at moneysense.ca. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You've been dreaming about leaving your 9-to-5 job to pursue your own business, and now you think you're finally ready to turn that dream into a reality. But how exactly do you get your finances in order? Michael Contento is the CEO of My Blue Umbrella. It's an IT services company. He's here to talk about some of the things you should think about before becoming your own boss. Hello there.
Hi.
You were an entrepreneur yourself.
Yes.
So you learned all this the hard way.
Absolutely.
What do you think is different for entrepreneurs when it comes to personal finance?
Great question. What is different today, I think, is we live in a much more of a commoditized world. So being in Toronto, I think starting your own business today, competition is much, much more fierce than what it was when I was starting back in, 25
the early
years
1600s.
Ago. Yeah. So there's a lot more thought. There's a lot more process in thinking of starting up your own company today.
Do you think the temperament of an entrepreneur is fundamentally different when it comes to personal finance? I mean, the stereotype is that you have a much higher risk tolerance than the person who punches the clock.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say we think of thought first and plan for the thought later.
Right. So one of the things that we talk about is in terms of how one budgets. If you've got a job, things are much more predictable. You've got a list of invisibles. What are some of the invisibles that entrepreneurs in particular should have on their radar?
There's many. One in particular I will start off with is just this week, myself. Within a week, I somehow ripped two of my most favorite jeans.
Ugh!
It's just
now you say
terrible.
That as a jean lover. I bet you're a jean lover. So
I'm
those jeans were not $50 jeans.
No comment.
They were not $50 jeans.
My wife is listening. So.
Right. Those were not $50 jeans.
No.
I see why that example. So the invisibles are things like the surprises of clothing. Or
absolutely.
Do you put that in your disaster relief fund? Do you have insurance on your jeans?
Yeah, I should.
Because that is catastrophic?
I definitely should. No, not yet. Yeah. I'm sure the insurance companies will think about something like that soon. But no, but it's something as minuscule as a pair of jeans or clothing. It can be the inevitables that you never thought of before that are just right in front of your face. And you just don't think that there's a possibility that I might need to replace that.
How do you deal with the swings in income that most entrepreneurs, not all, but most entrepreneurs experience? There can be days when you are flush and days when you are lean.
Cross your fingers?
Yeah. Is that you your tip? Yeah. That's your big tip. This just in.
No, it's definitely something, I guess, at a lateral part of my career and entrepreneurship, is something I don't have to think about much anymore. But I in the beginning as an entrepreneur, I weighed on a lot of boring funds first, unfortunately. But risk tolerance was always something I calculated as much as possible.
If you had a do-over, would you have done that part the same way?
Yes.
You would have?
I would. My first investment, I borrowed off a credit card. It's probably the dumbest thing to do, and financially it's probably not advised to do. But that's where the risk and reward kicks into place.
Have you yourself ever got caught in the tax trap? It's one of the things that entrepreneurs sometimes forget.
So you know what? It is so funny you asked that particular question. We have been audited many times and never did we get caught. I think when we taught ourselves accounting, we taught ourselves not well or proper, but we really stuck to the textbook model and therefore we did everything somewhat right. So every time we got audited, we did it right accidentally, I think. Audits happened. In our case, we got lucky because we never did anything incorrectly.
My first year outside of the traditional corporate world, I didn't set a penny aside for taxes. Didn't even occur to me. And then I had the tax bill and just got my head handed to me on a platter.
Now, on the personal side of taxes.
Oh, good. Now I'm rolling up my sleeves. Now yeah. I'm listening.
Yeah. As an entrepreneur, yes, I got dinged quite a bit a few times where, you make. As an entrepreneur, there's a lot of things You don't contribute to EI. You don't contribute to CPP. There's a lot of other tax ramifications that happen as the owner-operator, which I didn't take into effect until that tax man came.
How did you know it was time for you to start your own thing? Because that is one of the questions entrepreneurs, even if they've got the idea, they have to think about, both the head perspective of pro-con and the heart of, am I willing to just make the leap?
I was one of the lucky ones. I was stably, financially stable at a full-time career. I hit a limit of creativity at my current job. There was nothing else I could learn at my current establishment. And because I had the opportunity to build my career or my company as a secondary position, per se.
Like a side hustle?
Side hustle. I was officially my Bumble's third employee. So I started a company. I hired my first two employees. And then when I hit that limit at my current job, I jumped ship.
What is your one piece of advice you would give to new entrepreneurs about getting a handle and keeping a handle on their money?
Know your numbers.
Know your numbers. Were you always a math person? Was that comfort zone for you?
I was, but I wouldn't say numbers are – I do well with numbers, but I wasn't a math person. So I learned the concepts of math more in business throughout my entrepreneurship days.
Know your numbers, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Contento, CEO of an IT services company called My Blue Umbrella, with notes from the battlefield on how to be an entrepreneur and get and keep a handle on your money. One of the ways that I think we can improve how people behave when it comes to money is to talk more about it, which is why we started this segment. It's called How I Do It, and it is a series of basic questions about how our guests manage their own personal finances. And I would not ask any question that I wouldn't answer myself. So rest assured, Sandra Martin, that I'm not going to put you in a position that I wouldn't be put in myself. Sandra Martin, editor-in-chief of MoneySense.ca. Going to ask you just the first thing that comes to your mind, okay?
All right, I'm ready.
You buy coffee at a coffee shop, or tea, or whatever your beverage of choice is. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit, and why?
I actually just recently switched over to paying debit, and the reason I paid with cash was to visually see how much I was spending on coffee shop coffee. Right. But I was holding up the line. So
what do you still use cash for?
Almost nothing.
Yeah.
Really, it's if one of my kids is going on a field trip and needs money for lunch.
That's right. I'm still in the babysitter phase, so I pay the babysitter in cash. What about your financial life is automated?
I just moved to a new place in a townhouse in December. I downsized a little bit, and actually almost everything is automated now. I was paying my gas bills and hydro bills manually, but via electronic banking, and now it all just comes out. I trust it now.
Retirement savings automated?
Yes.
Vacation savings. How do you handle vacation savings?
I have a TFSA, and you know, one could argue that I could bucket it a bit better. I have a TFSA for all of my sort of medium-term fun things that aren't necessary, and that's where I save for a vacation.
Do you have a budget, and if so, what does it actually mean?
You mean, do I say I'm not going to spend more than X number of dollars on groceries?
Well, this is why I ask you to define what a budget is, because a lot of people will say, oh, yeah, I have a budget. And then I ask them what that means. And it isn't my definition of a budget.
So I'll tell you what, I have the same attitude towards the old school budget where you have line items and you're not supposed to spend more than that as I do about diets. Once you set that limit for yourself, your brain is going to want to rebel. Like I would say 90% of the population, 10% of the population thrives with that kind of structure. But 90% of us, the reptilian brain takes over and says, well, F that. I'm going to spend more than that on coffee. What I have is a specific amount of money that I spend per month on everything, because I surveyed what I've spent in the past, and I know it should not go over X number of dollars. And I put that, which is one of the reasons why I now put everything either debit, mostly on credit, because I have a cashback credit card that I want to maximize, and there's no minimum that I have to spend to use my credit card. And then I get this annotated list created for me for free because I use my credit card. So it allows me to see, oh, right, I did that haircut, and I let the person talk me into that other thing that week.
Yeah.
That's why it's a bit more this month. Am I okay with it? Yes. Okay. It's a one-time thing. Am I okay with it? No. What do I need to change going forward or watch going forward?
What are you nuts about when it comes to your money? And what are you casual about? Like, you know, I've been terrible. I've used this example before. I'm so casual about insurance and price comparing insurance and keeping on top of it. But I'm still nuts about groceries. I am a ninja in a grocery store.
You know what? I am not a ninja in the grocery store. I do the rule about shopping the outside mostly because I like to eat healthily. I cook at home a lot.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of those processed, expensive middle aisle foods. So, again, it's like the rest of my quote-unquote budget. I know how much it's going to cost me per week to feed myself and my kids and the two dogs. So I'm kind of relaxed about that. So if one week I really want to, like, buy a nice steak from the special section, not from the styrofoam tray section, I will let myself do that. I'm really cheap about gas.
Oh, you're one of those people who you would drive a mile to save a dime.
I would drive many miles with the needle on E if I didn't like the price of gas that week, and I have done that. It's kind of silly because I don't clock that many kilometers per week, but I'm just very cheap about gas.
Who manages your investments? Are you a DIYer, a robo, or a full-service advisor person?
I have a little bit of each, actually. So when I was in my 20s, I was finally in a job that paid okay and was sitting on some money. And a colleague of mine who was, he and his partner were in their like early 40s, and they had an advisor they really liked. And I got some mutual funds through this guy. This was, you know, actually just before I started at MoneySense, and the markets were starting to ramp up, and really you couldn't go wrong. And I made a bunch of money on some mutual funds that I bought inside my RRSP, and I've just never gotten rid of the guy. So I don't really use him a lot. Like, I don't meet with him every year, but he's still, like, we still correspond, and he still has that portion of my investments. And then the rest of it, I kind of DIY. I don't have a robo, although I kind of feel like I should. It might
for research.
I keep saying, for research. And also, I mean, I know a lot of the people you know in the biz, so if I want to find out about something, I just ask them. But I should, because it's kind of high time I consolidated stuff. But it's a little bit of everything.
Well, maybe that's your homework of our conversation. I appreciate your disclosure. It's super insightful to know how you do it.
Well, thank you for having me anytime.
Sandra Martin, editor-in-chief of MoneySense.ca. That's our show for today. You can subscribe to it on any of the podcast platforms out there. Feel free to write a review or give us feedback directly. We're happy to take your emails to ask@moolala.ca or on social, Facebook, Bruce Celery Moolala, or @BruceCelery on Twitter. Thanks very much for listening, and have a great day.